Okay. So if you remember way back when we first started this whole series, by now more than a year ago, Kanahara, we did not start with Sefer Shmuel. We really started at the end of Sefer Shoftim, and the reason was because Shmuel HaNavi wrote Sefer Shoftim, and he thought that it was pretty clear that the end of Shoftim was something we needed to have in mind before we began Sefer Shmuel, especially the way Rashi understands the Pesukim at the end of Shoftim, that the Pesukim are not written in chronological order. If the stories at the end about Pilegesh Begiva and Pesal Micha and the whole disaster and civil war that B'nai Yisrael fall into actually happened earlier on in B'nai Yisrael's history. So Shmuel is specifically placing it at the end of the book because that's the message he wants us to have in mind as we transition to Sefer Shmuel. So we saw at the beginning of the Sefer, B'nai Yisrael were at absolute rock bottom. Civil war, anarchy, disunity, Shevet Binyamin against everybody else. And from the very beginning of the Sefer, the whole mission was to get out of the hole. Right? Shmuel was trying to get out of the hole, and then Shaul is trying to get out of the hole, and David is going to try to get out of the hole. So it's important to have that in mind this week, because as we see the first parak where David is really going to transition explicitly towards, an open role of royalty. So we're going to see that hole has totally come back. It's going to be a parak of civil war, and it's going to be a parak where a lot of the really all of the not as intense, but the disasters we had at the end of Sefer Shoftim are kind of rearing their heads again. Right. So we're not in a good place in this parak, and it's important to remember where we've come from and where we're going. Okay, so let's load up the spreadsheet here. Here we go. Okay. So the parak begins, right? We ended last week with David's kinah. So now, shift back into the real world. If I had to split Sefer Shmuel into two Sfarim, I wouldn't want to. It really should be one book. But if there had to be a Shmuel Beis, so Shmuel Beis really should begin with parak, with the second parak. The first parak really, as we saw, was just a continuation of the back and forth, as Shaul comes to an end and David's star rises. So now the pasuk tells us at the beginning. So David is now in Ziklag, right? He's back in that city, which is kind of on the border. It's a city that used to belong to Shevet Yehuda, but now it's been taken over by the Plishtim. So David wants to know, okay, now that Shaul is dead, should he return to Eretz Yisrael or not? And the truth is, David really has three options. One option is David can stay where he is in the land of the Plishtim, and he can hope that the Plishtim do not realize that David had absolutely planned on backstabbing them during the battle against the Shaul. The second option David has is that he can go back to Eretz Yisrael, but he can once again travel in the wilderness like he had before. And the third option is to really make a move now and go to the cities of Yehuda, which David has not done until now. In other words, David is asking Hashem, is now the time for me to really make the move and openly declare myself king? And the Malbim points out what's critical is that David does not make this decision on his own, right? The Malbim writes that from beginning to end, David never took one step to take the throne by himself, right? Malbim writes, he never did it when Shmuel anointed him king. He never did it when Shaul was chasing him. And even now, says the Malbim, after David has been told that Shaul is dead and Shaul's children are dead, nonetheless, he does not make a move. Maybe there's one surviving son who we're going to meet in a couple of seconds. Maybe that's the one who Hashem wants to be king next. It's still not yet time for me to rule. So that's why David asks. And this is the consistent theme. And it's not just a question of asking Hashem, but it is the core question for whether you're going to be a successful Jewish king or not. Right? It's been the essential message from the first parak of Sefer Shmuel. Whose will is going to win? The person's will or Hashem's will? That was the test that Shaul failed. There's no question if it's up to David, if David had his druthers, he would get up, leave the land of the Plishtim, go to Shevet Yehuda, and serve as king. He very much would like to be a king. That's been clear from the way he's been acting until now. But he's not going to go and do it, right? He's going to ask Hashem what the answer is. And if he's told don't do it, he's not going to do it. But first he's going to ask. He's not going to assume, he's going to ask, right? Malbim points it out. So David asks, earlier in Sefer Shmuel, when David was asking the Urim and Thummim what to do, so he did not ask correctly. Now David has the system down. He knows how to ask. You ask one question at a time. So first David asks, should I go to one of the cities? And Hashem says, yes. And David says, which city should I go to? And Hashem says, Hebron. So that's where David's going to go. David's going to go to Hebron. It's going to be the first capital city, right? It's the biggest city in Shevet Yehudah. It's going to be the first city of his, first capital city of his kingdom. We should note that the Navi uses this word, Aleh, right? Going up over and over and over again. And on the one hand, there's just a very simple topographical reason for that, because David is going to ascend from the coast and from the hills of the Shvelah. So he's going to go up to the mountains. He's going up to Harei Yudah. So he literally does have to ascend. But it's clear from the fact, again, right? It's certainly not an accident that David's travel to Hebron, where he's going to be installed as king, is associated with rising. Right? The Navi is certainly making an opinion over here. David gets to Hebron, and what happens? It's totally organic. He does not declare himself king. He doesn't have to. There's no military coup or anything. As soon as David shows up, the leading men of Yehuda come. They anoint David, and they crown him as the king over the land of Yehuda. Right? So at the beginning of Perek Beis, David is only the king of Shevet Yehudah. He's in the city of Yehuda, down in the south, down in Hebron. Then we have something interesting. Then he tells us that these people told David that the men of Yavish Gilad buried Shaul. Okay, piece of intelligence for Shaul. Don Micker has an interesting suggestion. It would fit some of the previous things we've seen that we're going to see again. And maybe the men of Yehuda thought that David would be upset at Yavish Gilad. You know, how dare they bury Shaul? They should have left him with the Plishtim to rot. A suggestion, if that's the case, and once again they have misunderstood David, because David never had it out for Shaul. He never does have it out for Shaul. So David turns to the men of Yavish Gilad, who we saw a couple of weeks ago, repay the old kindness that Shaul had done to them when he saved them from Nachash, the king of Ammon. So the men of Yavish Gilad went and they rescued Shaul's body from Beit Sha'an in the Galil. So David sends messengers, and it's very important what he says. Right? It's very important what he says. It's very important what he doesn't say. David does a couple of things. First of all, he sends a nice diplomatic message. It's a bracha for the kindness that they did. So he recognizes what they did. He gives them yashakalach. Then he says, Yas Hashem, Yimachem Chesed Emes, Hashem should be good with you. Okay, very nice. Right, David says, I'm very happy you did this. Kamenochi Yaset, Chematovazos, I certainly do not hold this against you, right? I'm on your side. Now, David says two things about Zion. First, he says, Tachzakna Yedechem, let your hands be strong, which we'll see the Barbanel is going to say in a second. And he says, you know, I've also been anointed. You guys should know, public service announcement, I've been anointed as the king of Yehuda. So he's sending them a bracha. He's telling them he's happy with what he did. He's telling them to be strong. And he's telling them that I am king of Yehuda. Now he is not telling them that I am king of Klal Yisrael, right? He is not claiming rule over these people in Yavesh Gilad. Let's remember, Yavesh Gilad is way up in the northeast. On the other side of the Jordan River. Now, a couple of things. First, a clear contrast that the Navi is drawing over here. We've seen this phrase, Bruchim Atem Lashem, for Chesed. We've seen this before. But in the total opposite sense, back in Parakaf Gimlo Shmuel Aleph, when David was on the run, this was the most telling line. Really, if you had to sum up Shaul in one line that he says in all of Shmuel Aleph, this may have been the best one. Where the men of Yehuda from Ziph, right, from Ziph, come to Shaul and they tell him where he can find David on the run. And Shaul tells them, right? Your chesed to me is amazing. And you're going to get a bracha from Hashem for helping me, your chesed to me, in finding David and tracking him down and killing him. Classic, classic Shaul. He assumes what he wants is what Hashem wants. He gives the people a bracha from Hashem. One parak after he destroyed Novi or Kohanim, he's giving up brachos from Hashem. He thinks they're absolutely true. He thinks they're absolutely genuine. Now we have David using very similar language. Once again, to the other Shevet, right? Shaul was saying this to Shevet Yehuda. And now David is saying this to people from Shevet Binyamin. Except everything else is the exact opposite, right? First of all, it's not a bracha for doing chesed to David, right? David says, you know, Ruchim Atem Lashem for doing chesed to Shaul. And more importantly, David is correct, right? It was a wonderful chesed what they did to risk their lives to bury Shaul, as opposed to what's happening over here when Shaul was, you know, happy with them for trying to get David killed, right? So we have another point of contrast between David and Shaul. And the Abarbanel notes the other important point from David's message, which is, hey, says, why is telling him techazakna yadechem? We have to strengthen yourselves. Well, Abarbanel says, Klai Yisrael had a tough time. We just lost a devastating battle up in Har Gilboa. So Abarbanel says that David is giving him a pep talk, which means he is not claiming kingship over them, but he's talking like a real leader. I'm standing up in the south, says the Abarbanel. Right? You know, the Plishtim just won a huge battle. Are we going to capitulate? No, we're not going to capitulate. I'm standing firm in the south. I can help you. You need to stand firm in the north. Let's make an alliance. That's how the Abarbanel understands this message. And David is doing two things. One, he's just giving them yeshar koach, recognizing their chesed. He does not want to fight them. These are Shaul's core supporters, the hardest core. They're the original Shaul loyalists. They're probably from Shevet Binyamin. They're the ones who Shaul did the most for. They went and buried him. David does not want to have any beef with these people, right? He's not claiming kingship over them. He's proposing an alliance. You know, we should focus on the common enemy. It's not a time for civil war. It's a time for us to unite against the Plishtim. That is the original hope and vision that David has when he first is installed as king in Hebron. But we'll see over the rest of the parak is that that hopeful vision for a very, you know, quick reconciliation between Shevet and Yamin and Shevet Yehuda is going to totally fall to pieces and be an epic disaster. So let's see. So now the parak, right, so we shift our attention to Avner ben Ner, Sarat of Asher l'Shaul. So he's Shaul's cousin, the general of Shaul's army. Apparently he was able to survive the battle at Har Gilboa. He was not killed. And he takes someone you've never heard of before. Lakach es ish boshes ben Shaul v'yireu machanayim. So he takes this person ish boshes. We'll talk about the meaning of ish boshes in a couple of minutes. But he takes this person ish boshes, who we've never seen before, and he brings him over to machanayim. And the truth is, Ish-boshes, we're only going to have around for three prakim. But the first pasuk that introduces him to us really tells us all we need to know. What is he doing in this pasuk? He's doing nothing, right? He's doing nothing. He is being taken. He's supposed to be the king. He's going to be crowned. Avner will crown him in the next pasuk. But he is completely passive, and he is completely controlled by his uncle, the much more powerful, much more experienced, much more energetic and charismatic Avner ben Ner, who essentially is going to set Ish-boshes up as a puppet king. And from beginning to end, Ish-boshes, a very nice guy. David is going to call him a tzaddik and a couple of prakim, but he completely lacks any of the willpower that Shaul had, you know, in terms of establishing and founding a monarchy and using his force of will to get everyone behind his back and pushing back all of Klai Yisrael's enemies. You know, we'll appreciate Shaul more the more we see his son, right? Shmuel Aleph focuses so much on Shaul's flaws, but once you have someone else behind the throne and on the throne, we can understand so many of his advantages. This guy, he's just not going to bring it. Okay, so pasuk tes is a funny pasuk. First, v'mecheu al el hagilad. So he's crowned as king over Gilad, and that's the other side of the Jordan River. V'el ha'ashuri. Okay, Ashur, that's the Ashur's land is right on the other side of the Jordan River. That makes sense. The El Yisrael, Yisrael, that's the valley. We'll talk about that in a second. That's very surprising because they just were wiped. They were chased out of Yisrael by the Plishtim. That was that valley from a couple weeks ago. Baal Ephraim, Ephraim, which is in the heartland of the country. Baal bin Yamin, Yamin is a little bit farther south than that. Baal Yisrael Kulo, and then over all of Israel. So what is going on with this pasuk, which is mentioning all of these things? So the Matsudas David explains that this was a gradual process. We start with Bnei Yisrael in total chaos. The Plishtim have just won a massive victory. And now the question going forward is, are they going to press the advantage and reoccupy the country the way they did in the beginning of Shmuel Aleph after they destroyed the Mishkan at Shiloh? Or are the Jews going to be able to regroup and maintain their independence and begin to push back? And what seems to happen, and the Navi pays very little attention to it, but if we dig into this pasuk, because the Navi is not going to focus on Avner's accomplishments. The Navi is going to be very critical of Avner for what he did, and for good reason. However, this pasuk belies, or behind this pasuk is some major, major successes that Avner has. And to this David says, right? Gradually, the kingship spread from place to place. One by one. Until by the end, he is the king over all of Israel. And I should have put a map in here, but I'll just use it with my cursor. He starts, Gilead will be over here, then Ashur, then Amek Yisrael, then you'd have Ephraim, and then Binyamin. So the kingdom, initially at least, seems like it is successful. The Dat Mikra points out, Emek Yisrael, that's the valley where the Plishtim chased Bnei Yisrael out of, and yet all of a sudden here, Ishbosheth is being crowned by Avner in the valley. There are no Jews in the valley. So Dat Mikra points out, apparently Avner must have won an incredible victory over the Plishtim in the north, counteracting what the Plishtim had accomplished in the end of Shmuel Aleph. And the Navi doesn't tell us about it. And the Navi is not going to tell us about it because we're not interested in knowing about the history of the time. That's not our focus, right? The focus is much more from a religious perspective. We're going to be critical of Avner. But we should appreciate the background here, which is he's having some incredible success. He's an excellent general, right? He's politically savvy. And it seems like things are in a good way. And Pasuk Yud tells us that that Ishbosheth was crowned. He was 40 years old. Now he comes off. He sounds very young, but he's a fully grown man. Ushtaim malach, right? And he reigned for 2 years. Now this is a little bit challenging because the next pasuk makes clear we have to explain what's going on. Ach beis Yudah hayu achrei David. So Yehuda's following David. Ishbosheth is never in charge of Yehuda. And then the next passage tells us that David was in Hebron for 7 years. So the question jumps out. Wait a second. Ishbosheth's time is going to end at the same time that David becomes king over all of Israel. So how can David be in Hebron for 7 years and 6 months, but Ishbosheth only be king for 2 years? So there are two main approaches in the Mefarshim. One is, did I put them down here? I'm not sure I did. One is just to say that that Ishbosheth, this whole process took 5 years, and then Ishbosheth ruled for 2 years over that united group, right? So it took 5 years to conquer all this territory, and then he was king of it for 2 years. Or you divide it the other way. You say it took 2 years. Pasuk doesn't mean that Ishbosheth reigned for 2 years, said that after 2 years, he reigned, And then he's going to be king over this area for 5 years. Okay, either way, that seems to be what is going on over here. So there is an initial period of success, and then there's going to be a period of time where Ishbosheth is king of everything, and then it's going to quickly fall apart. Okay. So the state, yeah, sorry, I'm scrolling. It says, where did he take Ishbosheth? So he took him to Machanaim. Which thing he chooses Machanaim. Where is Machanaim? Machanaim should sound familiar because we saw it in the Kriyas Torah last couple weeks ago. Machanaim is the place that Yaakov named when he saw the Malachim right on his way back from Lavan. So Machanaim is on the other side of the Jordan River. It makes sense, right? Yaakov was coming down from Aram. So here's where he meets the Malachim. Right? So Rashi says the Malachim of Chutz Laretz are leaving, and the Malachim of Eretz Yisrael are coming. So it's right near Yavesh Gilad. And it's interesting that this is the place that that Avner chooses. You know, from a security perspective, it's understandable, being as right now the Plishtim have just conquered this whole area, right? The whole area of Emek Yisrael, which we said Avner is going to win back. Right now, this is all Plishti territory. So you want to go over the Jordan River. So it'll be safer. The farther east you are, it's safer. And we said that Yavesh Gilad was an area of core support for the house of Shaul. So they're going to do something right near there. But I think it also is not a coincidence that both David and Avner are choosing capital cities, which are prominent locations from Sefer Bereishis. All of Sefer Shmuel, we've seen references to Bereishis again and again. The founding of Klal Yisrael and Sefer Bereishis and the founding of the monarchy are associated with each other. Hashem tells David to choose Hebron, obviously one of the major cities of the Avos, to be his initial capital. And Avner chooses Machanaim, which also has massive symbolic value, right? The place where Yaakov Avinu comes back to Eretz Yisrael. So Avner chooses that place. Strategically, it makes sense. Symbolically, there's a lot of weight behind the Machanaim. That is where Ishbosheth is based. But a bit of a spoiler, we'll see David is going to be so absolutely successful in his ultimate reunification of the country that when David has to run away from Yerushalayim during the Avshalom rebellion, he's actually going to run to Machanaim. So this is actually going, they're going to so transition to being David supporters by the end that this will end up being David's city of refuge. But for now, this is where Ishbosheth is based. Okay, notice the word about the name Ishbosheth that the Damikra points out is, and I think this makes a lot of sense, is that if you look at the Rehayamim, he's not called Ishbosheth. And the truth is that it's a very odd name. The man of embarrassment. I mean, why on earth would Shaul name his child the man of embarrassment? You know, we'll see. The name kind of fits based on what his career is going to look like. But like, you know, that's not a name that Shaul would choose. So in Divrei Hayamim, he's not Ishbosheth. He's Ishbaal, right? Man of mastery. The Zatmikra suggests that, and we'll see, it's clear this is right. It's really interesting that the original name was certainly Ishbaal. And that they later on during Bias Rishon, it got censored. The Jews censored the name. We're used to the Christian censoring. Here, the Jews censored the name and censored it from Ish Baal to Ish Boshes. Right? Let's say the reason why, and then we'll give the proof. The reason why you change it is because what happens to Bnei Yisrael over the course of Bias Rishon? The worship of the Baal becomes extremely widespread. Right? Lahavdil, it would be like, if someone had the name Jesus in their name, we would change that out, right? Because like that name sounds very different, now than it would have sounded like in 100 BCE. That's basically what happens with the name, with the word Baal. So Baal is changed to Boshes, embarrassment. But it's not to make fun of Ishbosheth, right? It's really to make fun of the Baal, which everyone is running around worshiping. How do we see that? Because we have this idea again and again. We have many, many Bosheths in Sefer Shmuel. And we know that the real name is Baal. So for example, later on in Perek Yud Aleph, Yoav is going to send a letter to David during the Uriah Chiti episode. and is going to talk about Avimelech ben Yerubeshes. There's no such person, Avimelech ben Yerubeshes. It's Avimelech ben Yerubal. Gidon, the father of Avimelech, Gidon's name is Yerubal. But it's censored, right? It's changed from Yerubal to Yeruboshes. The same thing is true with Mephibosheth. We'll meet Mephibosheth in a couple of weeks. Yehonasan's son, David's Rebbe. Well, Divrei HaYamim, he's called Meriv Baal. The same thing. So we should just know, you know, we're going to call him Ishbosheth, but Shaul was not naming him to make fun of him. The original name was Ishbaal. Okay. Now Avner has made Ishbosheth king, and he's had success. But we should know from the get-go that Avner should have known better. And the Navi is going to be critical. Avner should have known better. We're going to see next week that Avner will say to Ishbosheth, when they have a falling out, that he knows full well who is supposed to be king. He's going to tell Ishbosheth next week, Kasher nishba Hashem leDavid, kin esalo lavir hamamlacha mibei Shaul. Avner knows that Hashem has promised the kingdom to David. He knows that Shaul was supposed to be replaced by David. Rashi quotes Chazal that there's a drasha that Avner came up with, that there would be two kings from Benjamin before David, but it is clear that that is a rationalization on the part of Avner. Avner wants Ishbosheth to be king, because if Ishbosheth is king, then Avner has all the power. Because it's from Shevet Binyamin. It's his family. The guy's a piece of milk toast, so he can really run the whole show. It's a classic case of the exact opposite we talked about with David, and the exact flaw that Shaul had. Replacing the will of God with his own will. It is that simple. It's that simple, and Avner knows it. And yet, it's so easy to come up with the rationalizations. You know, it's an emergency. I have a drasha. We need to beat back the Plishtim. I need to do this to crown Ishbosheth as king. And yet, at the end of the day, it was not the proper course of action that's going to lead to disaster. And it makes sense. We know that that Avner knows this, because remember, Avner was there. He was there with Shaul when Shaul said to David, "I know that Hashem is making you king." Shaul said to David, "Yadati kimloch timloch makam v'yarcham lachas Yisrael." And who's right next to Shaul then? Who's his right-hand man? Avner. So Avner's there. Avner knows that David's supposed to take over. Avner knows that he's been anointed by Shmuel. Everybody knows this. And yet, he just goes in his own direction. What is that going to lead to? It's going to lead to civil war. Pasuk Yud Beis. Avner takes his men. He goes with his men from Machanayim to Givon. Let me go back to the map for a second and see if Givon is on the map. Yeah, right. So he's going from Machanayim over here to Givon over here. Why is he going there? Probably because, as we said, he's been busy expanding the boundaries of Ishbosheth's kingdom, first in Gilad, then in Yisrael, then in Ephraim, then in Binyamin. Givon is really the southern border, what he wants to be the southern border of the kingdom. And here you have Shevet Yehuda over here. So what happens as he marches his men south down to Givon? Who is going to bump into him? It's amazing. It's the first time we meet him like this. Yoav ben Tzruya, David's nephew and the general of his army. Yatsu leif kashum al brechas Givon. So it's clear that this is not an accident, right? He knows that Avner is marching south. So Yoav takes the men. Yoav, most masterful general we've ever had, and certainly a man of force, a man of action. We'll spend a lot of time with him in the coming weeks. So he immediately marches north, and he meets Avner and cuts him off at the pool of Givon. And now we have this like awkward standoff. You know, you could hear like the Western music in the background as the two cowboys like show off with their guns on either side. Just a point as an aside, this might be a little bit cute, but it might not be. You know, this is the first time we really are ever introduced to Yoav. His name was mentioned once earlier because we saw Avishai ben Tzruya go over with David when Shaul was asleep. And the Navi then had to mention over there, Avishai is Yoav's brother, because Yoav is the one who's in charge. You mentioned Avishai, you have to mention Yoav. But we're actually mentioning him here for the first time. And what really is going to sum up Yoav is he's extremely loyal to David, but at the same time, he's his own man. So I just think it's very interesting that when we're first introduced to Yoav, it's Yoav ben Tzruya ve'avdei David. And it's like Yoav and David's servants. Well, is Yoav one of these servants or not? It's kind of ambiguous, right? You have the servants and you have Yoav, but they're together. It's really, it nicely sums up what we'll explore in depth in Mirsa Hashem in the coming weeks. Okay, what happens? So they meet at the Brechas Givon. It's awkward. It's intense. So Avner says to Yoav, and Chazal criticized him very harshly for this, Yakumu naha ne'arim v'sachaku lefaneinu, right? Let's have the lads, some of the soldiers, go and play before us. Now, playing, that is not a Jewish way to talk about warfare. We've seen one person in Sefer Shmuel talk about warfare like it's playing, and that is Goliath. You know, that's not the way that a Jew talks about war. And we see, right, that's the morals are being infected. Spiritually, Avner and Yoav were not in a healthy place. Yoav says, okay, fine. And it's the same imagery as Goliath. We have Avner's men on one side. We have Yoav's men on the other side. There's the no man's land in the middle. They both go. They send 12 men. The Malbim says it's not a coincidence that there are 12 men, that Avner chooses to send 12 men from Binyamin. It says the point that Avner is making is that the kingship belongs to us. And we have, you know, almost all the 12 Shvatim on our side. So David sends 12 more as well. Okay, or Yoav sends 12 more as well. David is conspicuously absent from this whole episode. And then somehow, right, as they're fighting, you know, like some like gladiatorial combat, so whether people get a little heated, get a little carried away, but they end up all killing each other. And that, you know, we have to appreciate, like, it wasn't just a game, right? When these two armies face off, tensions are very, very high, right? It is a tense environment. They battle against each other, trying to show off who's better at fighting or not. People, you know, you can imagine one person gets nicked, one person gets wounded, he gets angry, they start fighting. All of a sudden, there's a melee. All 24 people are dead. The two armies are watching this on the two hills, and they lose it. And all of a sudden, you have this outright battle. Not just a regular battle, right? It is a very fierce battle. The emotions are running extremely high, and Yoav wins. Avner and his men have to retreat. Okay, so that then leads, as Avner is retreating, leads to one of the most incredibly ambiguous passages that you'll ever find. Right, this is the Rodev passage, the passage where Asael, the third brother, the brother to Yoav and Avishai, chases after Avner. And we should see, it's amazing how the Navi, you know, gives us both sides. It's so timely, you know, the cases in Wisconsin and Georgia in the news. It's amazing how gray the Navi paints this, right? So the Navi tells us that there are three sons to Tzruya, Yoav, Avishai, and Asael. Clearly, they're being listed in order of who is the most powerful. Avishai may have actually been the older brother, but Yoav is the first. Avishai is the second. Asael is the third. Asael, he was the sprinter. Now Yoav and Avishai, those are the real warriors. Navi tells us Asael is the sprinter. Asael kalbra glavka charatziyam asher basadeh. So Asael chases after Avner, clearly thinking that this is an opportunity. If he can kill Avner, this will end this whole battle, this whole war, right? You kill Avner, then it's all going to fall apart. Ish-bosheth has no chance without Avner. So, you know, why bother looking, go fighting the common men? Take out the head, take out Avner, and that'll end everything. So he locks in on him. Lo nato lachas alimin v'asmal achrei Avner, right? And the Navi really says, you know, he's locked in on Avner. We're going to play up. We're going to play up how little choice Avner had. Right. Are you Asael? Right. Clearly, they know each other. I am. Right. So Avner says, "Look, don't do this. Right. Turn right, turn left. Save face. Fight some common soldier. Take his stuff. don't fight me, right? He gives Asael a warning. Asael refuses the warning. Avner gives another warning. Why should I have to kill you? Then I'm going to face you of your brother, which is not going to, it's going to be pretty awkward. It is going to be pretty awkward. So we have two warnings. The Navi gives off the impression of Asael as being extremely stubborn, right? He refuses the warnings. He's locked in on him. Then what does Avner do? Avner just hits him with the back of the spear. It hits the fifth rib. And Asael drops dead. And everyone who sees it is totally stunned. The Yoav's men are chasing after Avner's men, and then they find Asael lying dead on the ground, and they're just in total shock. So there are two extremes. The Malbim reads this in the most pro-Avner way possible. Right? It says Avner was completely justified in what he did. Right? He warned him. Asael's a Rodef. Textbook case of Rodef. Now, what's the halacha of Rodef? Halacha of Rodef is if you can kill him without, if you can deflect him without killing him, you're obligated to do so. So the Malbim says, well, it was a freak accident. What happened? Say, he hit him with the back of the spear. So he tried to just wound him with the back of the spear. It's not so dangerous. He was running, so he just blindly stuck the spear behind himself. Terrible luck. It happened to be that the back of the spear hit in the worst place possible, and it was just a terrible, terrible accident. Right? That's the perspective the Malbim gives. Super pro Avner. He was just a near daf. He was being chased, and there was nothing really that he could have done. Now, what's so interesting is that the Malbim, who normally is very very interested in connecting the Gemaras and the Chazals to the Pesukim, so Gemara and Sanhedrin has Yoav give a different side of the story. Now, the Malbim is not going to be bothered by that, because the Malbim is going to say, yeah, there's what happened, and there's Yoav's perspective. But the Gemara and Sanhedrin narrates the court case between Yoav and Shlomo, when Yoav is placed under arrest, and Yoav and Shlomo says to Yoav, you are liable for murdering Avner. Now, it's a little bit scary to have to go toe-to-toe with Shlomo HaMelech in a courtroom, but Yoav is up to the task. So Yoav says he was a rodei. Shlomo says to him, what are you talking about? You should have wounded him, right? So Yoav says to Shlomo, oh, really? He didn't have a choice? Like the way the Malbim says? The way the Malbim said it, he just stuck his the back of his spear, and it happened to hit him in the fifth rib? Yoav says, no way. Hashta, b'dofen chamishis kivenle. Avner is a master warrior, and he hits him in the fifth rib, right below the heart, in the perfect place to kill him, and you're going to tell him, that's a coincidence? No way. He could have hit anywhere in the body, says Yoav to Shlomo, that was deliberate. Now, maybe it was, maybe it wasn't, right? The way the Malbim will understand it is that Yoav had a plausible claim that it was deliberate, but in reality, it was an accident. We'll never know. You could read the Pesukim either way. But one thing we should point out is that the way the Malbim understands it, where like, oh, he used the back of the spear. So Radak and some of the other Mefarshim say that is not nearly as safe as you would think. How does the back of the spear pierce all the way through Asael? So Radak says, no problem. You have to know a little bit about spears. And we'll see that Radak is right. Now, that's why I'm holding off on the bottom of the source sheet for a second. It says, you have a spear. Sherosh eitz hachanis mechudad. Ubo barzel mechudad. Right? Where the butt of the spear is sharpened and has iron. Ubo barzel mechudad. Why do you have a sharpened bottom of the spear? Asui latak o baaretz. Because you want to plant your spear in the ground. Right? Which, if you have somebody charging at you, So you get your spear there, but you don't just hold it, you plant the spear on the ground, that gives it much more force, right? Sure enough, see this thing? This looks like a spearhead, but it's not. This is actually the sharpened bottom handle of a spear. What's the word for it in Greek? Like, I looked this up. I'm gonna write this down. Sauriter. I'm sure I'm butchering the pronunciation of that. But this is what the spears were like. I think the Radak points out that when earlier Shaul's spear was planted in the earth when he went to sleep, that's because it looked like this. Hey, you have this. And by the way, apparently they would use this in an emergency. If let's say someone's fighting and the spearhead broke off in battle, you could also use this as an emergency spearhead. It's not quite as sharp as on the front end, but it could do a lot of damage if it's used the right way and done in the right way. So there's just total ambiguity about what the story is exactly with what Avner did. And it really just fits the whole general parak, which is who's right, who's wrong. Nothing's clear. Everything's ugly. Nobody comes out looking good about this. No one comes out looking good. You know, Asael doesn't come out looking good. Avner doesn't come out looking good. Yoav's not coming out looking good. Nobody in this whole parak is going to come out looking good. It's all ugly. It's all ugly. And then we have one of the leading members of Shevet Yehuda who's dead on the ground, from just this just total collapse between the two groups. And what makes it even more tragic is that it would be one thing if it was like at the end of Sefer Shoftim, the last time we saw civil war between Binyamin and Yehuda, right? There, it was a civil war with anarchy. Who's the leader? There's no leader. There was no leader in Yehuda. There was no leader in Binyamin. So you had anarchy, civil war. Here, what's even worse in a way is that there was a civil war, and yet there was extremely capable leadership on both sides. Yoav and Abishai are incredible generals. Avner is an incredible general. The very next couple of psukim show what both of them are able to do. Where we last left off, Asael is killed. And then the men of Yehuda are shocked and they can no longer pursue. What happens? Vayirdafu Yoav Avishai acharei Avner. Of all the people in the whole army, it's Asael's own biological brothers who are able to pick up the pieces, get everybody going, and keep the chase going. They're going to do this again, by the way, in a few prakim from now. This is their MO. They are extremely charismatic and inspiring leaders. They lead from the front and they get their men going again. The sun is setting, okay? The sun is setting in Givon. And what happens at the same time? Avner also shows incredible leadership. His men have been running and retreating helter-skelter. Avner is able to reorganize them. Avner manages, it takes incredible power and skill to get the retreating men together, reorganized, reshaped, get on a hill, get yourselves in a good, secure, defensive position again. You see masterful generalship on both sides, but leadership we don't see from anyone. And only now, after the fatalities, does Avner say to Yoav, "Halanetzach tochal cherev," as I titled the shir, as I say, "Shall the sword devour forever?" What are they doing? What are they doing with the civil war, right? And they each talk about brothers. Stop brother fighting brother. In this case, literally, right? Yoav and Avishai's brother is dead. What is going on? Yoav, Chai Elokim. It doesn't say Chai Hashem. Yudke Vavke is not here in this parak. But they agree. We should stop the civil war. Stop the fighting. Yoav blows the shofar. And then they call off the battle. It could have happened so much earlier. It's just a tragedy, right? The fact that the generalship was there and they could call it off and they could have the maturity that they talked to each other at the end, if only they could have done it at the beginning. You're just left. It's just an ugly, ugly, depressing episode. And if we think about the history of where they are, it gets even worse in a sense, because where they are in Givon, it sends us back to two things. One, it sends us back to the last civil war between Yehuda and Binyamin, that hideous episode of Pelegash Begiva, which now the men here at the generals have slid back to. but also we consider the fact that they're in Givon, and we have people chasing in Givon, and the Navi is referring to the sun setting in Givon. And now, by the way, Avner is going to have a night-long march in Givon. We can't help but think of last time that happened in Givon, which isn't Sefer Yehoshua. Sefer Yehoshua, it's not Bnei Yisrael fighting each other when they were in Givon. Shemesh b'Givon dom yerech ha'ayalon. Back then, it was Klal Yisrael united, fighting against the Canaanim. Right here, we have the Plishtim who are ascending. We have the Plishtim who are marching in the east, and the Plishtim are marching in the south. And David had began the parak by telling the people from Yavesh Gilad, "Why don't we get along and focus on pushing back against the Plishtim?" No. Now we're in that same place in Givon. The sun is setting, and we're chasing all night. We're not chasing after Plishtim want to kill us. We're not chasing after Canaanim. We're chasing after Jews. It's just a total collapse. Total collapse. Right? And David is going to have to reassert leadership in the coming time. Right? Welcome to the situation. Truth is, right, whenever we have Yoav and David, it's just so complicated. Moments where David looks magnanimous or David looks wonderful, Yoav is going to look not so great. Moments where David looks worse, Yoav is going to pick up the slack. And there's a case where we see all the good and all the bad. We see from both Yoav and Avner, the charisma, the energy, the skill, the power, and yet, right, yet the big picture just isn't there. Now, the last point, just to pick things up a little bit, I forget who pointed this out, but it's a good point to make, is that, so Avner marches all night long, right, they go through the Aravas, they go up the Jordan River Valley all night long, and they go back to Machanayim, and Yoav does the same thing. Yoav also marches back all night long, Yachu Kol HaLaila, except in Yoav's case, Vayeor Lahem B'Chevron. The Navi makes sure to let us know that day broke upon them in Chevron. Yeah, in the Dat Mikra introduction to Sefer Shmuel, so they point out that night and day generally in Sefer play a huge role. So like, for example, we talked about this when Shaul was crowned king, everything was happening in the morning. Right? First thing in the morning, he's up there with Shmuel. Day was emphasized many times as he's being crowned in front of everybody. When Shaul is falling apart, everything was happening at night. He goes to the woman at Ein Dor at night. Everything was dark. Here, once again, right? It's night. It's dark when Avner goes back to Machanayim. It's dark. It's night with Yoav and his men and their burial. And yet they get to Chevron, they get to the home of David, and here is where the sun is rising, right? Because at the end of the day, David is going to take charge. And the very next pasuk tells us that this was an unfortunate episode, but the civil war continued. Hatia melchama arucha ben Shaul ben Beis David, ben David holich bechazek ben Shaul holchim medalim. David is going to get stronger and stronger, and Beis Shaul is going to get weaker and weaker. They never should have set up their own kingship, right? And it meets with initial success, but it was a step that never should have been done, and it just leads to civil war. It just leads to destruction. So we'll see. Avner is going to get his Mida Keneged Mida for all of this next week, and it's just a tragedy. But even as the tragedy is there, right, David is rising. He's back in Hebron. He has his men. Yehuda's come to him, and things are starting. We're at the bottom now, but things are going to pick up and pick up quick. Okay, so wish everyone